For several years now, the levels of mental health and well-being within the UK police have been in decline. Many will argue that this is a result of an ever-increasing workload, a reduction in capacity and experience, underfunding, and a perception that social and mainstream media proactively portray a negative narrative of law enforcement within the UK. Additionally, lenient sentencing, poor organisational practices, and the disproportionate time spent on officers under investigation have contributed to create a perfect storm. In this short series of podcasts, I will be looking at the rising trend of police officers taking their own lives. I will be speaking with a variety of people to put a spotlight on police suicide, the reasons behind it, and hopefully how we can halt its rise. I'm delighted to be joined today by Lana Boland. Lana, welcome to the podcast.
It is absolutely my pleasure.
This podcast has been a long time in the planning, I suppose. You've recently written a book called Aftershot. It's your experiences not only of life, but also as a serving police officer within the Canadian Police Force. And we're going to delve into that book. It's if people haven't read it yet, I do recommend that you do, because it's quite hard hitting. Before we talk about your book, Lana, tell me a little bit about your childhood.
I'm from a very, very small town. Here in Canada, the population is very sparse, unless you're in a major center. So I'm from Northern Ontario, and I'm from a very, very small town called Lively. And I describe it to people as such. If you're driving and it feels like the Blair Witch Project, because there's nothing around you, and then suddenly there's a few houses and a closed up gas station, possibly a grocery store and a Tim Hortons, and you wonder who would live here. And that is my entire family. We're all interconnected in Lively. My existence growing up was very much playing outside. We had not a mountain, but a very big hill next to our house. We would have bears walking down the street, eating our garbage. And I loved many portions of my childhood. But looking back now, I realized how much I struggled. And that's largely because of brain patterns that I have that we didn't know I had. I'm twice exceptional, meaning that I have two separate brain patterns and they both oppose each other. So I would only register maybe 20% of what people were saying to me. And that lended itself to a lot of bullying, which I was very ashamed of. I struggled in school. I remember very vividly in third grade, there was a bulletin board behind me and our job was to copy the images and the words and just put it on a sheet of paper. It should have been simple. And I could not turn my head. And I remember crying and crying, and it was awful. I was in dance and I couldn't remember the dance routines that we had. And that's largely because I was daydreaming, because I had a billion thoughts in my head at all times. So as magical as some parts of my childhood were, you know, we had a pool and a sauna and a hot tub. And, you know, I was raped when I entered high school and went to my first party, which kind of made my world upend. And then I was sent to a Christian boarding school, which I don't talk about in the book, but essentially we weren't allowed to dance because that would lead to relations, I suppose. We weren't allowed to wear pajama pants in public because the same principle. It was a very judgmental school, to say the least. And somehow, when I was at that school, I sort of turned my perspective around, mostly because I wanted to go home and I didn't want to be in boarding school anymore. And then I had a really good high school experience when I went to our local high school. And I actually still have the very same friends to this day. And I do talk about them in my book, where I have the best group of friends. And then university, that's when I really thrived, where I'm interested in politics. And I've learned that when I'm really interested in something, I will focus on it. And then once I was medicated for ADHD, and just as a sidebar, I realized for the first time in my life that people smile at each other. And I realized that when I was walking into an arena to my kids' hockey game, that, you know, people smile at each other when they're walking by. And I realized that I'm just as capable and just as smart. And I realized their mannerisms, similar to when I was at the arena, that they like me. They like me because we're friends and I'm a likable person. So I spent most of my life self-loathing, to be frank. And when I realized that there was nothing wrong with me. In fact, I just have a different brain pattern than the norm, and it comes with its own superpowers. It's quite fascinating. But the minute that I was able to slow down my brain and have one thought at a time rather than, 4,000, and the narrator in my head somewhat quieted down for the first time in my life, I was really able to connect with people.
So where do you think this self-loathing came from? Was it down to the neurodivergency, or
absolutely
is it something more emotional?
No, I've done a lot of research on the brain since I was diagnosed, and it's very common for those with ADHD to self-loathe. And that's because we realize that we're different. We don't know why we're different, and we constantly feel like something's wrong with us. So we do everything that we can to fit in. We are sensitive by nature, and we just want to be liked. But our emotional patterns are very, very different. And I know in my experience, and I had a very hot debate with my husband about this because he thinks that this isn't possible, but I have never felt jealousy in my life. I know what it is, but I have never felt jealousy. It's just not within my realm of emotions. I have plenty of other emotions. I see what people have, and like, that's great. And if that's something that I want to, I ask them, like, how did you get from point A to point B? Because I want to do that. We just like essentially what ADHD is, the like back portion of your brain is underdeveloped. So you don't produce enough dopamine in order to do simple things like vacuuming and get motivation. It's very hard to be motivated unless you're super interested. So we're constantly chasing serotonin, which is why a lot of people with ADHD get addicted to substances. They overeat often because our brain doesn't tell us that we're full. I remember the first time after I was medicated, I was going to have like a giant burger. I felt physically ill trying to eat this. And it was the first time, and it had to be explained to me, your brain is now telling you that it's time to stop eating, because before it was just a serotonin chase. So it's interesting.
You raised the topic of addiction. I can't remember the guy's name now, but he said that the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, it's connection, which is a great, fascinating take on addiction. I like an addiction to trying to quench your thirst by drinking seawater.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. And it's to escape, which is the opposite of connection. So that's fascinating.
How old were you when you were diagnosed with ADHD?
I was in my 30s, actually.
Oh, that late?
Yes.
How did it affect your relationships with family and friends then, up till that point? Because clearly you knew you were different, and I'm guessing that the people around you would have guessed that Lana's a little bit different to the rest of us.
In my case, so what Twice Exceptional is, they had to send me for intelligence testing as well. So it turns out in two intelligence categories, there's five different categories. That's working memory and processing speed. I am utterly demented. Like, I am slow. So I have two learning disabilities, and they're both related to processing and memory. However, in fluidity, spatial awareness, and verbal comprehension, I tested off the charts, 98, 99 percentile. In those particular intelligence scales, I was so high, I was able to mask, is what we call it. That's sort of the term, where I was able to kind of fit in or just assume I knew what somebody was talking about. My parents constantly wondered why I struggled, because in fourth grade, they did conduct intelligence testing on our entire class, and I tested quite high. And my parents were like, what? Like, you are capable of all of this, and yet, you're struggling with the simplest of things. So I think people perceive me as hyper, quirky, I'm all over the place, unable to sit still, and unable to focus or follow instructions. My friends and my family just sort of chalked it up to part of my charm.
Well, you say you're diagnosed in your 30s with ADHD, and you just mentioned it to me now, but you also mentioned it in the book about how the fact that you were raped. And I think, would that be one of the drivers, at least, of why you considered a career in the police force?
That is the very reason, in fact. I was only 13 years old when this happened, and it happened actually a couple of times after that, but this one sticks out because I was only 13, and it was the beginning of my high school. It took my friend telling her mom, who told my parents, because I didn't want anyone to know. what had happened. I was ashamed. I was actually, because we were drinking at the party, bear in mind, I'm from Northern Ontario. It's very common to drink at 13 years old. And I was scared that my parents would find out that I had beer. And then my parents called the police and I refused to report it because I was terrified. I didn't want to go to court. I would have nightmares about going to court. In fact, I didn't want to be interviewed. I just didn't want people to know. And that obviously caused a great deal of damage because I thought it was my fault. And when people at school started to know, obviously some were horrified where others accused me of lying. I remember one of his friends saw me in front of a mailbox, smashed my head into the mailbox and spit on me. So having that experience, I realized that I was in a position where I could find others like me, vulnerable teens that, you know, just feel lost. And I was successful in that, where there's one victim in particular who her sister dragged her in, and it happened to be me. And we talked in length, and I ended up actually helping her through her struggles through school. I would attend her therapy appointments with her, and she didn't trust any other adult. So I was successful in that. And that was precisely my goal, was to find those like me that were terrified. And, you know, they're terrified for a reason, because court is scary. Being interviewed is scary. And then being accused of lying is even scarier, especially when you already think it's your fault.
Do you know what you've just described is a really common experience of rape victims in the United Kingdom, not only children, but adults as well. I would suggest that there's a lot of unreported rapes that have happened for the very reasons that you've described.
99%, I would say.
Some of the reasons I do these podcasts is a similar reason to what you've just described, in that I'm always looking for other people's stories. People become a lighthouse for other people because of what they've gone through. And I suppose I do these podcasts, in a sense, to kind of illuminate my own journey.
Makes sense.
You eventually went on to write a book, and I think you said that you didn't plan to write a book. I planned to survive for one more hour, and then I started writing down the things no one saw, the parts that almost no one knew. And it's a common therapy, I suppose, for people with PTSD, is to write things down. I know several people that ended up becoming published authors and become very successful at it.
It's a little bit funny how this began. So when I went off work, essentially my brain exploded. I was assigned a work psychologist through our workers' compensation. So you have to attend psychology. It's part of your job now to heal from PTSD and get back to work. This actually lends into my neurodivergency as well, that my psychologist, before she really knew me, really wanted me to journal. I think she gave me 9 different journals. And number one, couldn't do it. And number two, I remember saying to her, journaling is stupid. No offense to anybody who journals. What am I going to use that for? Like bedtime reading? Why do I want to write this stuff down? That, like, journaling just to me just seemed to be a waste of time. And then when I started just speaking out very in a private way on my private social media, she said, Lana, you have a way with words. And I said, I do. Yeah. And she said, you're going to write a book. Like, if you're not going to journal, you're going to write a book. And I said, excuse you. I don't even own a laptop. I have not had one since university. I don't like computers, and I'm certainly not sitting down and writing a book. I don't know how. Stephen King is my hero, so all writing I compare to his, and, you know, it's just too much. But she made me buy a laptop in session, and now I had to justify said purchase. So to appease my psychologist, I would go, and it was May, I would go outside and I have this massive egg chair and I would just write like anything that was coming to mind. And, you know, my book started very much like at the beginning of training and why I became a police officer. And every day I would go out and just write again. And then lo and behold, in 30 days, I had a whole book. And then within 4 days, I had a publishing house. I had a few publishers actually reach out to me, but the one that I used found me. By July, I had a contract and my book was released in December. So this time last year, if someone had told me that I was going to be a published author, I would have looked at them like they had 17 heads. And it's true. I was just trying to survive at that time. And writing the book actually caused more physiological impacts, because I think everything is connected in your body. And I did have a very dysregulated nervous system. And still to this day, I'm dealing with physiological issues that are mending, but it takes a long time to mend those issues because your nervous system is the microphone to the rest of your body. So if it feels it's under attack, it overproduces skin cells, traps hair, stomach issues. It has been brutal, but it's all part of healing. I wrote my way back home and I had no idea that my story was just mine. It seems to belong to many people globally and not just police officers.
Well, certainly some of the things that you've described in your book, I recognize within the United Kingdom, and we'll talk about that in a moment. So how old were you when you became a police officer?
So I was actually a civilian before I was sworn. I graduated into the economic recession of 2008, which we all remember when, you know, debt was being traded for debt and, you know, just the world economy essentially collapsed. So there wasn't jobs for political science students. And I remember vividly walking my dog and I was watching other people in their business suits and I was so resentful. So I started writing a paper about postgraduate syndrome where I said, you know, you're going to have a bunch of university graduates that are going to end up unhoused because there's no jobs for us. Like, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. So I was at a barbecue and I was ranting about this and someone said, aren't you so-and-so's little sister? And I said, yes, because again, very small town. And she said, well, the records department of the local police service is hiring. You know, I could put in a good word for you. So I applied and I got the job. And that was the beginning. And, you know, I was writing these reports and I ended up moving to another police service because I moved to Southern Ontario and I worked in courts and the front desk and I was looking at the reports, what the officers did. And I was like, hey, you know what? I said, like, I could probably be a police officer. So I'd started as a civilian when I was 24. I would say about 27, an inspector sat down with me for about 3 hours and said, you know, you'd make a fabulous cop. I call myself a people McNugget. I'm very tiny. Like, it's a joke that, you know, all of my kids' friends had the same shoe size as me. So he said, you know, you get training for that. So I figured out how to get from point A to point B because I wanted benefits. I wanted a secure job. I could see what the police officers were doing. I'm like, I could do that. And by the time I was 28, I was fit enough to pass all the physical testings. It was before I was very unfit. And I had to teach myself math because, again, I struggled at school, especially with math. I had my mom tutored me. She was a teacher. And I passed all the testing and then I was hired as a police officer and I had benefits. So that's how that dream began. And I think I started in training when I was 29.
Just looking at the timeline, you wouldn't have been diagnosed with ADHD at that point. Is that correct?
Correct.
And therefore, the police force that you joined would not have been aware of your ADHD either. So how did your ADHD affect you whilst you were going through the training and the response that you had from your colleagues and supervisors, I suppose?
In police school, I remember falling asleep in class all the time and I couldn't stay awake. It wasn't that I was trying to sleep. It's just like I was trying to focus. And because I don't have that level of focus, I would fall asleep. And again, daydreamer. So this is sort of another portion of training where police school was okay. 4 days before I had commenced training, I was running and daydreaming, head in the clouds, and I slipped in dog poo. And I twisted the main ligament of my foot. A lady in this red minivan came to pick me up and she said, I saw that was a nasty spill. Yeah, it was. So my foot blew up like a balloon and I ended up going to my first day of training wrapped in like fluorescent green kinetic tape, trying to keep the swelling down. So I was benched in the beginning from any sort of physical training. So I went to physio day in, day out, and was issued a medical boot. So my foot was in a constant flex, but I did have a period of time where I wasn't as fit. And that's really important to be fit when you're going through training. There's tests that you have to pass. So I was told to just do the bare minimum to pass the test. Don't injure yourself further. So I didn't push it. And when I got back to my service, when we did our first round of use of force training, it was the first time that the head trainer had seen me, you know, running, performing. I remember sprinting and I threw up, which that was the first time he saw me. So he just assumed I was weak, on top of which I'm a tiny female. So that none of this helped my cause. So he targeted me He choked me at one point during a water break. He would make me push those sleds by myself because I would come in last for any sort of like anaerobic activity. He would scream at me in front of all of the brass that was in the hallway saying that I was always last, always last. At one point, we were doing outside training and he told the group, our class, that if you went with a group of people for these training scenarios, to be pelted with sim rounds, more or less, but that meant that, you know, you're too strong as an individual and you need to work on your teamwork. However, if you were selected to go by yourself for these scenarios, that it meant you were weak. And lo and behold, my name was the first called by myself. I was humiliated. He criticized me. And then I went again by myself and then again. And then a couple of groups went and then he called my name again and I couldn't take anymore. And I just ran away. And then I had a trainer follow me into the bathroom where I was cleaning up my bleeding head from being pelted with sin rounds. And she said, you know, you're not being targeted. No, no, no. And I ended up having to go back. And then he made me do another scenario. And it was humiliating. And then he, despite passing everything with flying colors, he went to the head of training and said that I didn't have enough heart to be sworn in. I just don't have it. So my badge was taken away at the badge ceremony.
You're joking.
Nope. I was forced to sit in a hallway for 2 weeks. Sometimes I would join in-service training and I had to wear like my recruit tag, even though our class had long graduated, was on the road. So it was 2 weeks. And then I was sworn in very quietly at the courthouse. And then I went to my division with this narrative following me that I was essentially an incompetent boob.
Going back, you said that your supervisor strangled you?
Yes. Chokehold.
Proper strangled you?
Yes. I was coughing and tapping out, and it was during a water break. He just grabbed me and put me in a chokehold in front of the entire class, and I was tapping out, and I couldn't breathe, and he kept going until, like, he finally just suddenly let go, and I remember just being on the ground coughing.
Was there a reason why he did this?
We were on a water break. I was just drinking water. Like, we weren't even in session.
Well, it sounds like humiliation tactic more than a physical.
Over and over and over.
So you've not had a good experience?
No.
In your training as a police officer. I'm guessing you're putting that down to your ADHD and the perceptions that they had of you, of just not understanding the person that you were.
Well, I think it's because the initial, when we were sprinting and I threw up, and that was because, you know, I had a torn ligament in my foot, so it was in a constant flex and I wasn't as fit as I normally was. Yeah, it's true that I struggled with following instructions. So they assumed that I was just lazy or taking shortcuts. This is my assumption. Yeah, it was rough beginnings.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because certainly in the UK, we've got the Disabilities Act and it covers everything from physical to mental disabilities. And the law in the UK at least says that your employer has to make reasonable adjustments. Did nobody sit down with you and think, a bit of professional curiosity, rather just take the easy way out of just assuming that you were lazy or unfit? Did anybody say, Lana, what's wrong?
No. They just said I had a lot of excuses. That was the narrative, that I had an excuse for everything, which I didn't think that I really had an excuse. And I tried harder, or would ask to redo something if I didn't do it correctly. And then that was sort of twisted and turned around on me. And if somebody had asked me what was wrong, I wouldn't really have an answer aside from, you know, I am not as fit as I normally am just because I had an injury. I'm really sorry. But I didn't want to say that because it would just be framed as an excuse. So I just sort of kept my head down and took my lumps.
Well, your bad experience of being a police officer didn't end when your training finished, did it?
No.
And I think you had a few experiences whilst operational that affected you.
Well, in field training actually went pretty well. I had decent coach officers, but my shift obviously had this narrative. And there's one particular occasion that I talk about that the situation could have become very lethal. There was only two of us and I screamed for more cruisers. It was during shift change. And I learned later that the officers just sat in the division and they didn't come. And I was told to actually by the other officer that was there. He was the one who told me that they just sat there. And then like officers did come, a sergeant from the road came along with a couple of others. But I always wondered if it was because of me.
It's really difficult, isn't it, when you're having a bad time at work, because I should imagine just getting up in the morning and going to work must have filled you with dread.
Yes, sometimes. When I had issues with people on my shift, luckily at that time I had an excellent staff sergeant and I really liked my sergeants. And they, I think, saw a lot of value in me. I did eventually prove myself over time as to be, and I was surprised when someone told me this, that like, you're one of the tougher chicks. And this is just quote unquote in this division, like you don't take shit. And I don't know if it was just hardened or whatever, but I still kept my head down, but I was tough. So it wasn't like toward the end, I was projectile vomiting on my way to work. But I think my supervisors sort of helped me out in this. And I appreciated my sergeants and my staff sergeant. The shift, on the other hand, it was difficult beginnings.
What you're describing is classic bullying in the workplace. You can't say it any other way. Now, I think the incident that you were describing where you were requesting backup and nobody came, certainly that is a cardinal sin. You don't back up your colleagues in the police because there's nobody else but us.
Well, I can't confirm. It was just something that, you know, came across my mind. I can't confirm whether or not that was the case or, you know, they just wanted to go home. That's, we will never know. But those are the facts of what happened.
I suppose the reason is irrelevant. If they knew you were needing assistance, yes, and they didn't come for whatever reason, mm-hmm, that's awful.
I was nearly bottled. It ended up being, we were sequestered afterward because one of the accused ended up having his teeth knocked out in a door frame when finally other officers arrived. So we were all sequestered afterward, but it was, yeah, we were nearly bottled and fight was on.
After the incident, the Special Investigations Unit looked at the incident and the roles everybody played. There's a passage in your book where you say, when we were done, we submitted our reports to the waiting oversight investigators. And that was it. No debrief, no aftercare, no real check-in on how we were doing, just more calls already waiting in the queue. And that really resonated with me because that is exactly the situation that we have in the UK.
On that particular call, we actually were sequestered while, like, it was a night shift and my shift ended at 8 a.m. and we were there until noon. So we actually had left, slept, and then returned to work the following day. And I remember that set being wild. But yeah, there was no check-ins. And I remember, you know, I talk about my first fight when I was in field training. And I remember it was my first adrenaline dump. I'm sure you've had one as well, where you're just exhausted and you kind of see sparkles afterward. And like this huge guy that, you know, had woken up out of a drunken coma and then just came at us. And there was only me and one other officer. And I remember just, we went from like him standing, lunging at us to me being on top of his body on the ground, holding his head, trying to get his arms behind his back. You know, officers did respond. Like my field training officer basically went through like the little, like, you know, when you have plexiglass and there's that little space where you can transfer money. He went through that to get to me like Batman. It was crazy. We pretty much just adrenaline dump and then back to another call and then to another call. And then rinse and repeat.
When I read that, what you'd written, it reminded me of an incident when I was on road policing. So we would police the motorways, highway patrols, I suppose you'd call them, over there. And we had two fatal collisions in one shift. It was crazy. I remember after the first one, you kind of go into slow time. You shut the road off and you're waiting for a collision investigation to come down and process the scene. And I remember the fire brigade that were there. I could overhear them and their boss was saying, right, we're going to have a hot debrief now, 15 minutes. We're just going to talk about what's happened. And then we're all going to go back to the fire station. We're off call now. We're off station and we're going to have a proper debrief. And I'm just standing, listening to this, thinking, what are we getting? And then the second shout came in for another fatal collision. What you've written and what I saw that day just proves to me and highlights the fact that care in the police service, certainly in Canada and the UK, is pretty non-existent. They talk a good game.
And it's worse now, I would suggest. I talk to officers all the time with PTSD, especially like here locally. And it was amazing to me, and this just sort of parallels what you're saying, is there's no care after. Like we sometimes debrief, but not really. And that's more in recent years that we have like very, very brief debriefs. But again, not really. I think I've been a part of maybe like one debrief and it was the next day and it was on parade. And then we just went out. We have an officer suicide epidemic that's also true in the UK and it's alarming. And I started speaking out against the suicide epidemic because my moral compass simply wouldn't let me do anything else. It wasn't acknowledged previously. And soon after I started speaking out, I'm not saying it was antecedented by me by any stretch of the imagination. However, the chiefs had this convention camping thing that was for officer suicide prevention. And, you know, who they didn't consult is us. Not one of us, especially and I'm very specific to my service, but it's a common complaint and actually a consistent complaint where it's true of every single one of us. The upper echelon has not reached out to us once. And that's, I think, by design, where they have rules or directives in place saying, oh, you know, you can't contact an internally injured officer. And that's even despite us trying to reach out to our services and say, you know, hey, let's talk about what led to my injury. Or I work very closely with a former supervisor. His executive functioning is so low. And he was served with discipline papers for just saying something simple. And this was after he went off with PTSD, where, you know, a bunch of cruisers showed up to his house to serve him disciplinary papers. And it was because he had asked why our newly appointed chief had not hired one deputy within service and simply brought his colleagues over from the service that he had come from. And in Canada, there's legislation that sworn members of society cannot speak ill of their chief or their service. So while his brain was in the beginning of exploding, and he has reached out to the brass a number of times, and it's always to crickets, he actually reached out to apologize for that comment at one point. Yeah. I think part of the shame is it's bad for optics. Nobody wants, especially those in leadership, don't want the public to know that there's internally injured officers and the number of them and how it happened. So it's much easier to shame officers. And this is just my opinion, into being separate and being separated from the service, ice out. And as long as, you know, everybody's kept separated and shamed into silence, well, then there doesn't need to be any form of acknowledgement that the mechanisms within the institution might have caused this harm.
Very definitely cut from the herd. It's always the same familiar pattern. That's it. Go home. You're not to speak to anybody. Somebody will contact you. Invariably, they do, probably months later. I used to work on family protection, which dealt with abuse within the family. Usually the person that was alleged to have committed these crimes wouldn't be allowed to go home, wouldn't have any contact with the family because there's children there. Not everybody is guilty. And part of the strategies that we had to put in place was the safeguarding of the suspect, because the potential for them to take their own lives. When you're a police officer and you're suspended, there's no well-being strategy for that officer.
There's no care. You know, if an officer is shot, everybody lines up at the hospital. If an officer is internally injured and, with suspension as well, obviously sometimes people get suspended because they're already internally injured and they may not be fully functioning at their job, or they might make a misstep in their personal lives and get suspended, and they're just shamed.
We have the IOPC in the UK. It investigates the more serious complaints against police.
We have the same thing, called the same thing as well.
Their investigations can take years and years. And I'm beginning to think that the process of that investigation is actually the punishment.
I could not agree more. I had one complaint against me and we were cleared years later, and I wasn't overly concerned because I wasn't a subject officer. But yeah, when you're under investigation, it takes forever and is very stressful.
I'm kind of flipping topics a little bit now, but certainly somebody goes off with stress or PTSD, certainly in the UK, you'll hit the 6-month mark. And then you will go down to half pay unless the chief constable decides that there are circumstances appropriate to keep you on full pay. There is a pressure for people to come back to work. Probably can't afford not to, but straight away people are being forced back into work.
Yep.
Into an environment that made them ill.
Yeah.
And they're not yet better.
So it's a little bit different here. So for my case, there was two different ways that workers' compensation would have covered me. One was through disability and one was through actually workers' compensation. So when you go off, when you're internally injured or physically injured, if it's proven that your disability comes from something that isn't directly work-related, it needs to be work-related, you go on long-term disability. And that's like, it's different for depending on how long you've been on the force. So you go down to 3/4 pay. And then it continually drops down. And I think eventually it just runs out. So you'd have to go on government disability, which is a fraction of what you normally be paid. Or in my case, I'm on workers' compensation, meaning I get full pay because my injuries were very explicitly work-related. And that had to be proven with tons and tons of paperwork and justifying my own injury through medical professionals. And I went off in May and I wasn't even assigned my medical professional until that September. So I was just on disability and using my vacation time until the diagnosis came through. And then we kind of alluded to this earlier. I had many, many different caseworkers or case managers in my workers' compensation file. And I recently had one, and this is actually how you and I talked for the first time. And my medical practitioner, so my psychologist, had said, you know, Lana's not anywhere close to being ready to return to work and you're pressuring her. So this particular case manager began calling me numerous times a day, just trying to decline my physiological injuries so they wouldn't compensate me for that. And then she sent me a letter saying that if my physiological impacts were not resolved, that she would be removing my loss of earnings benefits. And she was ignoring my medical practitioners when really her role should have just been administrative. And she was taking it upon herself to testify to my executive functioning based on the fact that I wrote this book. And it was about my literal near suicide. So luckily, after our initial conversation, I was able to advocate for myself and spell out the damage that she was causing. She actually caused a great deal of damage and put me backwards in time of my healing, where, you know, I was back to sleep paralysis on top of everything else due to the pressure of calling me, forcing me into meetings. So after I had filed a formal complaint, she was promptly removed from my file. But, you know, I had the skill set to lodge this formal complaint where somebody with no executive functioning, they would have just been forced back to work.
It was probably the easier option to go back to work for some people. And again, it's the process, isn't it?
And that's when you made the remark, you're being expected to heal in the place that made you sick. And that is what is happening widely. And actually, my employer prides itself on, you know, getting officers back to work at such a high rate. That was a public statement.
When were you diagnosed with PTSD?
So I was assigned my psychologist in September. I went off in May. It was pretty quick. It probably was my first or second session with a psychologist, and it was severe PTSD. And she actually explained that to this caseworker, and she said, you know, Lana was in really, really bad shape. She was projectile vomiting. She wasn't emoting at all, which like I thought was a good thing to not emote. Apparently you're supposed to feel your feelings. I was just essentially paralyzed with continually in like the frontal lobe of my brain in fight or flight mode. Like I remember walking down the street and feeling like an asteroid was going to come kill me. Just constantly on edge. It was brutal. I was in very, very rough shape and I didn't realize how rough of shape I was in.
I'm guessing that the people close to you, your family and your friends, they saw a difference in you.
I actually talk about this in my book where I was at a cottage weekend with my childhood girlfriends that, you know, we were talking about earlier. I would try to hide my symptoms as best I could, but they found me projectile vomiting and I made it to the bathroom and just like wailing. And they followed me from room to room to room as I was trying to get away from them. They were horrified. But they said, you know, we're not letting you fall, Lana. I'm like, we're here. But they absolutely saw a difference. And I actually talk about in my book, a group of friends. There was one particular person that was not great. And I was privy to later, my girlfriends were trying to help me and they had a group chat going on and she just completely dismissed and diminished my experience. And it was brutal, but largely I had a really good support network otherwise.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Did you lose any friends as a result of your illness?
Yes. In chapter, I think it's 5 and 6, and I had to rewrite chapter 6 like many, many times because my editor said, like, you seem angry. Where, you know, I had one particular friend who created a narrative about me that was completely untrue. I don't know if it was because, like, she wanted the attention on her. So the friendship group that we had that was so magical and so much fun was split up. And the kids were impacted. I was certainly impacted. And it still breaks my heart to this day for my kids because we were all so close. But otherwise, I didn't.
Did the attitude of your employer change once you'd received your diagnosis of PTSD?
I have not heard from them once.
That's shameful.
Yeah. The only time I did, so the association's allowed to contact me, but I guess nobody else is. There was a case that I just talk about in my book. I don't go into detail, but it was quite the scene. It went to court actually just last January, where the trial was set. And the officer in charge, who was one of the homicide detectives, he had to call the association to get them to ask me for permission to talk to me to see if I would attend court. And I said, absolutely, no problem. Like, anybody, like, if you need me for something, for a case, whatever, contact me. And I attended. Of course I attended, because I wanted that accused convicted, and he was. So, like, it's crazy to me that they stop people from communicating with me at all, even though I've tried to communicate with the brass. The attitude is no attitude. That's the answer, because they do not communicate with anyone with internal injuries.
I mean, I don't know. Is that a policy decision on their part, or is it just down to individuals or culture?
I think there is a directive that we are not to be communicated with, but I cannot confirm because I don't have access to said directives. But it's across the board, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't seem to matter what position you previously held. You will not be communicated with by anyone in the brass. Your colleagues are allowed to communicate with you, but they really didn't. You know, I've hardly heard from any of them. I think there was one or two in the beginning. And, you know, it's mostly now people, like, we welcome each other to the bin when you go off with an internal injury, and it's, you know, a joke. Usually it's just us who communicates with each other. And that's fairly new, where those of us with PTSD now have sort of banded together. And we've learned that we all have very, very similar experiences.
Well, I suppose the most important question of this podcast is how are you today?
Better. I'm not healed. I wrote the book in it. I was in it, and I'm still in it. I still have a hard time. I call it rising from the dead each day, where it's actually my ADHD medication that needs to kick in, which takes about 2 hours to even get me out of bed. I can't even move my head. It's a weird paralysis. So mornings are very difficult for me. And I have two little kids that need to get to school. So that has proven very difficult. I have a skin condition that, and when I talked about, like, you know, my skin cells were basically like en masse producing. So I'm still dealing with the after effects of that, which is pretty horrifying. But I'm in a healing phase, and the healing phase actually is somewhat more awful than the phase where everything was happening. My world has exploded in ways I never thought could ever happen. I wrote the book, and I didn't think it would go anywhere. And now, you know, I'm talking to you, and there's a documentary that may potentially be made inspired by my work. Magazines are reaching out to me, and I weirdly became, in such a short time, global. And it's crazy to, and I haven't fully wrapped my head around it, where people actually know who I am. I guess now, where I rise from the dead, and I usually have, whether I'm a keynote speaker virtually, or I have to go to a bookstore or restock, or I'm on a podcast, or I need to respond to the many, many messages in my inbox, that's sort of keeping, I'm a little more productive than I was, but it's still proving difficult. But I think that all of this advocacy is for a reason, and it's important to me. So I just figure it out and I do it.
It's very powerful what you're doing, actually.
Thank you.
It's a privilege to talk to you. So where does the future lie for Lana, the police officer? Because you're still serving at the moment.
I'm still off with internal injuries. However, I am active. And the answer is I don't know. So I know that I can't return to the way things were. I know that the culture made me very sick. And I would like to be a part of making change so that we lose fewer officers. Essentially, if we are more mentally healthy and happier, we're more productive and we'll be better officers just collectively. So I would like to be a part of that change. And I'm trying to push for that change. And I think step one is acknowledgement from leadership that, hey, we have a problem. How do we fix it? And that's going to need to be a collaborative effort. Institutions, they're not people, they're institutions. And institutions reflect society. And we give them meaning. They don't stand alone. So we could say that there's all of this red tape to create change, but you know, that tape isn't actually real. It's not physical. You can't touch it. It's just directives and rules and regulations, which those are essentially illusory. We can change things easily. And I think regularly, I think of structures, and the foundation of a house needs to be sound in order for the rest of the structure to function. And the foundation is, you know, the frontline officers, those who are making the policing world go round. And I think we need to return to authenticity in leadership, where optics matter, sure, but you know what matters more? Authenticity, spirit, and actually leading. There's a big difference between managing and leading. And I think a real leader inspires others to follow rather than be promoted and just have that title where you have this authority, but you're not necessarily leading. You're just managing a situation to maintain your power and your role, or secure the next promotion or the next political appointment. I think that the culture needs to change for Lana the police officer, and not just for Lana the police officer, from, you know, every officer that's been silenced, every officer who hasn't been recognized after committing suicide in police memorials, which happens regularly. So just a simple amount of respect and human decency, I think, is required.
Well, Lana, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. And perhaps the best way to finish this podcast is to go to the beginning of your book and a passage you wrote for your daughter.
For my daughter, who carries my middle name, my fire, and all of my hope. I wrote this so you'll never have to live in the shadows I did. So you'll never question your worth the way I once did. So you'll never shrink to make others comfortable, or silence your truth to keep the peace. The world has not always been kind to women who feel deeply, think differently, and refuse to break. But you will know better. You will know that your voice matters, that your light doesn't have to dim for anyone, that softness is strength, and that love, real love, doesn't ask you to become smaller to be held. I hope you never see the ugliest parts of this world. But if you do, I hope this book reminds you that you come from a line of women who faced it and still stood tall. That you are free, that you are loved, that you are worthy of protection and revolution. Everything I survived for you.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.